since they're on Ness Road. So it will be offered in person with limited seating to allow for social distancing, and also virtually. For in-person, doors will open at noon for a boxed lunch, and virtually the meeting opens at 12:50 to allow for time for everyone to eat their lunch. And of course, we ask that everyone wear a face mask and remain socially distant for the in-person meeting. So we'll have a couple of different speakers for this workshop. We'll have Chuck Audie, who's an agent in Geary County, who will be talking about kind of how to put together a good lease and the ins and outs of writing a lease and different considerations to think over. And then we'll have Roger McAllen with Washburn Law, and he'll be talking about ag law and then also lease law. So you can get some good information about the actual laws there. And then wrapping up the workshop, James and Wendy will be going over our pasture and crop lease survey.
All right, so a good one coming up here, and that's going to be coming up later this month. And we'll go ahead and David, we'll start with you this week. And what you want to talk about today is coyotes or coyotes, either way you want to pronounce it. We were talking a little bit about it off air about
You know,
the sounds they sound to make, because I was never sure if it was like a long howl or a little yips. So we were discussing that off air. But today your subject is going to be coyotes.
Yeah. I'm going to be talking a little bit about coyotes today, and I'm sure as any livestock producer is aware, coyotes are the number one predator of livestock in Kansas and in most of the western United States. So coyotes can roam in smaller packs or also individually. Individual coyotes will range over areas of about 10 to 25 square miles, and those ranges usually overlap to varying degrees. So you might have kind of like a couple different coyotes that aren't exactly in a pack, but are overlapping the areas that they range. And coyotes in Kansas, and pretty much coyotes everywhere nowadays, are accustomed to human odor. So they are active primarily at night, but they may venture closer to homes or livestock pastures in broad daylight if they have terrain or cover that is adequate to conceal them, where they'll feel comfortable moving around. In Kansas, coyotes also normally go under or through fences whenever possible. So although there are fences, you know, around pastures to kind of give that boundary of where the livestock are and protect them from dogs or other predators, coyotes will go under or through these fences. So they've figured out a way to get around them. And they're also capable of jumping or climbing over fences, and will do so in some circumstances. So they're pretty clever. Coyotes breed in February, so coming up next month will be their breeding season. And they will usually have one litter of 5 to 7 pups in late April or early May. And during or immediately following their spring whelping season, the coyote energy demands increase rapidly, as the parents are trying to provide food for the pups. And at this time, some coyotes are more likely, unfortunately, to turn to livestock as a readily available source of food because it's a convenient source. And in late summer and early fall, another increase in coyote predation is usually noted. But at this time of year, it's usually because the food demands of the large and fast-growing pups may tend to be more than the ability of the adults to provide for them with natural food sources. So you may notice if you have livestock that when it's been a really wetter than normal year, here we've been having wet years pretty consistently, then that helps food sources for rabbit and all other small game to be plentiful. So those communities will increase, and then coyotes will have a more natural food source, versus when we're in drought, those communities of rabbit and other small game will be decreased, and then coyotes will be more likely to turn to livestock for their source of food. But they're also kind of opportunists, so if they notice, say, chickens that are readily available, they may try to go for them. And also, like I was saying, domestic livestock may offer an easily obtainable source of abundant food, and the late summer increase in predation may also be related to the learning or development of livestock killing behavior in the young pups. So basically, the parents will be teaching the coyote pups how to hunt, and for that especially, they sort of tend to go for the easiest source because the pups are learning. So winter losses of livestock to coyotes are generally lower than at other times of year, despite the higher energy needs of individual coyotes. And they say this is probably due to lower overall coyote numbers, increased availability of other food sources, even roadkill, and reduced availability of livestock because it's winter, it's colder, smaller livestock such as chickens are more likely to be closed up at night, or livestock just move closer to pasture, closer to the houses, so they're not, may not be as comfortable getting that close to humans. And I talked about it a couple months ago when it first came out, but I wanted it to mention it again since the season has opened, kind of in relation to coyotes and coyote predation of livestock. The Department of Wildlife approved this past fall the use of artificial light and thermal imaging equipment when hunting coyotes at night. And this season opened the beginning of this month and will go through the end of March. And hunters that are wanting to use artificial light or thermal imaging equipment when hunting coyotes will need to purchase a night vision equipment permit. This permit is only $2.50, and it allows the use of equipment that amplifies visible light. And there's also a few other following guidelines that must be followed that I wanted to make sure people knew about. And of course, as I mentioned, the use of this equipment is only permitted January through March, and the using this equipment will require the hunter to possess a night vision equipment permit, which again is $2.50, and you can get that through the Department of Wildlife. Use of the equipment will be permitted for hunting coyotes only, and use of a vehicle when hunting with this permit is prohibited. And also, if you're using this equipment, it is not allowed on department lands or waters, including WIHA and IWIHA properties. So I just wanted to cover that briefly, as I know the passing of this law and allowing this equipment to hunt coyotes at night was kind of a topic of conversation earlier this fall. So now that the season's open, just wanted to bring it up again to make sure folks were aware of how to go about doing it correctly.
Yeah, I remember, I remember writing a story about that, I think a couple of weeks ago, just kind of reiterating, hey, it's coming up, and then a few of the laws. Obviously, you have to have the night vision permit, but also I think you're not allowed to use vehicles. Right. You have to basically be on foot to hunt them. But again, that did start this past, basically on the new year, and you said it was kindly hotly debated, but have you heard any feedback on it yet? Since I know we're less than a week into the new year, but have you heard any feedback on it as of yet?
No, I haven't heard any feedback on it now that the season has started. So I'm sure kind of as it gets closer to March and the end of this season, we'll probably start to hear how it went, feedback on if they're going to make any changes to it in the future. And I do know one of their reasons for the permit is also so they can keep track of how many people are actually making use of this change and allowing this equipment to hunt coyotes.
They're finding out if a lot of people are buying this, it's very popular and will continue to do this. Basically, it's kind of a way to see how many people are doing it and if they want to continue to do it, correct?
Yes, because they did this because they actually got a lot of feedback from the public, especially livestock producers that wanted to use this equipment to, of course, help protect their livestock from coyote predation. But, of course, it was a hotly debated topic.
And we were all three talking about during the break, and I could bring James in on this as well, but it was we were talking about how a lot of times you'll hear it now, you think maybe 20, 30 coyotes just all yipping back and forth, but a lot of times it's really not that many talking back and forth. It's just they talk so quick and so loud that you think there's a lot, but it may be only two talking back and forth at each other. In fact, I think somebody, one of you guys were telling a story about that just before we got on air.
Yeah, David was saying
like
there was a recording of just two coyotes, and it sounds like a lot more.
Yeah,
they're noisy little guys. They run around.
they like to talk, don't they?
Yeah, they do. So, like James was saying, and you mentioned as well, a lot of times it sounds like there's probably 20 or 30 of them out there, but it's actually just a couple of them talking back and forth.
It's because they're so loud, and their yips just travel a very, very long way. So, with that kind of like the echo, it sounds like there's a whole lot, but there's, like you said, there was only in that audio, there was only two of them talking, and they were both pinned up, didn't you say they were?
Yeah, Drew Ricketts, who's the wildlife specialist on campus for K-State, he did a lot of research with coyotes, so in his research, they had, and I forget where it was, I think it was some sort of wildlife preserve, but they had two coyotes, and they were in dog kennels, and they were fairly close to each other, and it was at night, and they had a video of them talking back and forth. So you could see that there was only two coyotes doing their yips back and forth. And if you hadn't seen just the two and had only heard the audio, yeah, you would have thought, or at least I would have thought, it was at least 15 of them or more.
They were basically talking about back and forth, hey, how do we get out of this kennel? We want out of here. give me a good idea.
You were talking about coyotes hunting livestock. Sometimes you have livestock that hunt coyotes.
That is true.
You have a real mean cow, and she'll go out there and she'll find those coyotes. She'll hunt them down. So.
Yeah.
And the coyote's like, oh, okay, mama's mad. I'm out of here.
Especially if they have calves. They don't put up with that.
Yeah, they get real protective real quickly. And the coyote usually ends up, all right, mom's mad. I'm out of here. So you don't mess with the angry cow mom. All right, guys. Well, we're going to go ahead and take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll have James on the other side of the break. And James, today you're going to be talking about, just kind of preview what you're going to be talking about here in the next segment of the show.
Hey, so I'm going to talk a little bit about basically fence line property laws. And so it's kind of it's a little bit adverse, I guess, with adverse possession. And, you know, sometimes there's some legal issues that come along with it. And so I'm definitely not a lawyer, but, you know, these situations do come up quite a bit. So,
all right. And that's what we'll be hearing about in the next segment of the show after the top of the hour. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this hump day morning. And welcome back to Green Side Up right here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Joining us back in studio is James Coover and it's David Skrantz. Guys, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Well, before we get started, James, with your subject, of course, there is a workshop coming up here a little bit later this month.
Yeah. So kind of connected to what I'm talking about today with the property line laws, we're going to have a land and lease meeting. Land, lease, and law meeting. And so this will be on January the 23rd. And you can join us virtually or in person, actually, at the Parsons Research Center there at the end of Ness Road. We'll kind of start the in-person part maybe around 11:30, a little bit before the actual program starts at 12:50. And so the virtual part of the program, we're going to have Chuck Audie and Roger McGowan call in. And Chuck Audie, he has been an extension agent for so long. If you never heard him, he's actually a Davin's a mentor. And he's so full of energy. And this guy's been doing this for so long. He actually gives a yearly lease meeting. And he's going to be talking about basically how to make a good land lease. And there are so many times when people call in, especially this time of year, where they don't really have a good lease. And they come up with issues and problems. And so the importance of having a good land lease, and January is the month to make your lease. Then also Roger McGowan, and he's another guy with just a great speaker. So honestly, this program has two really good speakers. Roger McGowan, he is the Washburn law professor, and he specializes in ag law. And he's going to be talking about basically a little bit what I'm talking about today, but also various laws when it comes to leasing. And, you know, after that, me and Wendy are going to talk a little bit about survey that we're trying to get done right now, if we can get enough people to fill it out. And so that will be on January the 23rd. It's a land lease and law meeting, and this will be a little bit in person, but if you don't want to come in person, we're more than happy to give you the Zoom link. Just call into our local extension offices and give us your contact info.
All right. And like I said, that'll be on January 23rd. That's on a Saturday. So there we go. Get your open up that weekend so you can attend that. Well, James, like you said, it kind of pertains to what you're talking about today. Today, talking about property lines and laws.
Yes. And so today I want to talk a little bit about the law of the fence between two properties. And so, you know, that fence actually has a specific name to it. But that fence between two property lines is not always on the property line. And I've talked a little bit about this in the past. And the real boundary is the line of the original deed, of course. And that original deed, of course, that was made way back in the 1800s, probably, you know, and depending on where you are in the country, it can go way back. But the fence can become the property line over time. It's not always technically the legal boundary, but it can actually become a legal boundary in a way. And so it does become a property line. And so fences, they can be built off a property line for all sorts of reasons. And the issue becomes when that fence is not intended to be if the fence isn't intended to be the property line, it's not an issue. And that happens all the time. Sometimes, you know, if there's a bunch of stuff in the way, a creek or a waterway of some sort, a fence can be built off of it, and that doesn't mean that becomes an issue. But, you know, if there is a fence built between two pastures that is intended, and that can be an issue. And so today I want to talk a little about adverse possession. And that's a fairly common term, and it's for both city people and country people, actually. A title of property can be acquired to property line through the usage over time. In Kansas, that's actually 15 years. In Oklahoma, I think it's 10 years. And same thing with Missouri. And so that usage of time is a little bit different depending on your state. The property must actually be used, farmed, or managed. And so it can't be just some place out in the woods where, you know, there was a fence line and the fence line gets moved. If not actually using the land, it's not really part of this adverse possession. And so I actually recently wrote an article, and there's a part of it that I got wrong. My understanding was that adverse possession was basically the unknown property line, but that's not right. Adverse possession means the person gaining the land actually knows that the property that they're using does not belong to them. And if true, the true owner, it could also mean that the true owner knows of the possession but does nothing about it. And so there's kind of two ways. It actually has to be adverse. That's the adverse part of it. You know that the land isn't yours, but you're still using it. Or you know that somebody else is using your land, but you're doing nothing about it. And so if the boundary isn't known, the courts can actually look at the intent of the property holders. You know, if it's just a mistaken line and there's really no intent of possession over that land, well, then it's not really adverse, and so it doesn't qualify under this. To change a title by adverse possession, this can be done formally by using what is called a quiet title, would not to be confused with a quit title, which is kind of a whole different thing. So quit and quiet titles. If it's not an adverse possession, a written agreement between landowners can actually move a line. And so this does make it a little bit on the legal side. It is sort of a court thing, although it doesn't really go through the courts. Two landowners can agree to move it. Often this will be a trade of some kind, you know.
It's like, I'll give you a little bit more land, but can I get this in return, basically?
Yes.
Kind of like a barter, somewhat.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, the property line is kind of wiggledy between the two. And maybe there's some land on this side that goes to one landowner and the land on the other side. That happens all the time, especially when rivers go back and forth, mm-hmm. and they move the boundary lines. And so, but this also, there's another one besides adverse possession called the doctrine of practical location. which is another aspect that comes into play when we're talking about these boundary rules. And so this is also called boundary by acquiescence, which basically means you remove yourself in a way. And so applies when adjoining landowners, they don't know where the boundary is, but when landowner manages up to the fence line. And so they don't know where that is, but they both manage up to the fence line, which is kind of the normal, a more common situation. So they think that the property line is there, but they don't actually know where it is. And so, you know, this over time, then the fence can actually become the property line if they're actively managing it. If either party knows the fence is not on the property line, then this doesn't apply. And so if they know it, then it becomes more like the adverse possession that we originally talked about. A survey beyond the original, and that's usually what happens, is that a survey is done and people find out that their fence line isn't on the property line. And then that's when the emotions start to get, because they find out that part of their land is on their neighbor's or part of their neighbor's is on their land. And so the survey is meant to be set upon the original. And so the original survey is really what the actual property line, even if the original survey wasn't really done very well. I mean, it was way back, you know, before satellites.
Right.
before
yeah, it was done by eye pretty much.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. But, you know, even if that was done way back when and the property line's all over the place, that's actually the what the technical property line is, whatever it was. And so every survey after that is with the intent of finding that original survey line. And new survey equipment can actually be helpful in that situation. A number of, you know, a survey beyond the original doesn't set the property line. Only a court can actually move a property line. And so that's an important piece to remember. Only courts can remove a property line. A number of laws and doctrines, they can come into play when all this comes to be, and land usage over time and possession of that land can be important when it comes to addressing these situations. And so usually the landowner that has been there the longest kind of ends up having kind of grandfathered rights, I guess you could say, into this. And so somebody who had just bought a piece of land, did some survey work and finds out, you know, that they actually own 15 feet on their neighbors, they're less likely, at least. But it really depends on intent and it depends on usage. And so the courts might also have what is called an equitable exchange, which is if the true boundary is going to cause undue hardship on the other person. I like to think of this as like, what if the property line is over a driveway, or maybe it's through a piece of a house, or there's something that just makes it impossible to really move that property line easily or take possession of that property very easily. And so then the courts might say, something has to be done here. And I'm not sure if that exchange can be basically a payment, there has to be some sort of exchange to make that property line right and make it easy on both people. So mostly I say this is that when you're building a fence, it's kind of important to remember these things, because eventually over time, that property line can actually set. That fence line can eventually set a property line. And so I recently wrote an article about it, and I was actually kind of off. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know. I'm just going by what other people who know more stuff than me say. But, you know, it's important to keep this stuff in mind when you're moving these fence lines and these property lines, because you want to make sure that over time things don't get messed up, because decades from now, no one's going to remember that stuff. I mean, the hedgerow doesn't always mean that's where something is at. Farmers planted hedgerows years and years and years ago, but you know, they're kind of all over the place sometimes. So
it meanders,
really,
you know.
Yeah, they meander, and often not. I mean, that meandering hedgerow sometimes actually can become the property line, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's where it's going to survey at. Right. So, you know, it's one of those things, and these issues do come up. I've probably had 3 calls in the last past couple of months, dealing, actually had a 4th one just a few days ago, where people are basically trying to adjust this situation. A survey of some kind ended up kind of telling them things that they did not expect. And so it's important to really know the laws. And if an issue does come up, you know, if you can't find some sort of mediation, of course, we have Kansas Agricultural Mediation Services that kind of goes to the lawyers and the courts to figure out what to do. And they will use these 2 doctrines to kind of philosophize what they need to do.
All right. So, again, some great information there. And like you said, sometimes just over time, those, like you said, the fence can end up being the actual property line, but it just kind of meanders. Occasionally, does it happen when a fence gets replaced and that it kind of shifts a little bit? Because obviously you don't want to tear down the fence and then rebuild another one right on top of it, because then you have an open space at that point. It's sometimes you build it because building another fence right next to it to replace the old fence.
That's pretty much almost always why it happens. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to build a fence into an old hedgerow. And so, you know, almost every farmer, and we've done it too, is build a fence next to a hedgerow. Well, I mean, you know that hedgerow is where the original idea of where the property line was, but, you know, over time, like, what side of that hedgerow does that fence get built on? And people would be surprised if they actually did survey work to find out a lot of the time the hedgerows weren't necessarily directly on the property line, and the fences weren't necessarily within the hedgerow. So you never quite know. And a lot of this stuff applies for city people as well as country people as well. And so a lot of the same rules, you know, for your lot inside town has some of the same ideas. Often not, the doctrines are kind of applied a little bit differently, at least from what I was reading on the internet. But the ideas between the two, the terminology anyways, adverb possession, all that, is all the same. And so I think there's like a movie, I can't remember, where there was a property line in somebody's house and they were having an issue with their neighbors. As it turned out, like, their part of their house was actually inside property line. And that happens in real life too. I mean, it happens all the time. But, you know, in the movie, I think they were just, I don't know, they like cut off a piece of the house or something ridiculous. That doesn't really happen. I mean, right. The court's going to work with you to make sure that the undue hardship part doesn't really happen.
Right, exactly. Where you can at least purchase that part of the land that your house is on or something. You know? Yeah. You can't have somebody just walking into your house and say, oh, this is part of my property, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, guys, I appreciate you coming on today. If anybody has any questions, though, about what we've talked about today, or maybe any other questions, how can they get a hold of each of you? James, you'll be first here.
Yeah, so they can call any of the local extension offices. We're pretty much all of Southeast Kansas. And so they can call the Girard office. The number is 620-724-8233.
And David?
And like James mentioned, you can call any of the offices. I'm usually at the Independence office. That number is 620-331-2690.
All right. Well, again, guys, thank you so much for coming on today. It was good to see you again this week. I hope had a happy new year this past weekend, and we'll see you guys again here in a couple weeks.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to go ahead and take a break, and when we come back, we're going to start Open Line. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.